The True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
If you'd like to skip the intro, please refer to the timestamp listed in the episode description. Thank you.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. It is Thursday, March 7th right now, 2024. My birthday is in 2 days. I'm going to be 33. So by the time this comes out, it'll have passed. But hopefully I had a great birthday weekend because life's been pretty stressful and tiring. I've been like sick for a week. You know, when you get a cold and it just lingers forever, it just seems like it takes forever to fully go away. That's where I'm at. I swear if I get sick with a cold or something, I'll just be congested for months after that. It's so annoying.
So hard to shake.
Yeah. So until I'm moving and all that, just God was like, be sick. And I was like, gee, thanks.
Had it on top of everything.
Yeah, but I am, as of, what was it, last weekend, finally got everything out of my apartment, moved everything out. So I never have to return there. Now everything is here. So still trying to sort through everything. Cats are still thriving. And I'm already feeling that, you know, how, because when I said I was buying a house and all that, everyone's like, oh, get ready. Like being a homeowner, you're just always spending money on things. There's always problems. And I was getting ready for work on either like Monday or Tuesday morning. And I was like, I already woke up 10 minutes late because I was tired, and that morning I definitely just suffered the 8,000 little problems. First, I got up and our washing machine, no, the dryer is super old, like we're gonna replace it eventually, but it doesn't have a handle and it's held with like a zip tie that was there already. So I had to get my socks because I can't find any of my clothes. They're all, half of them are still packed. I don't know where any are. So I went, pulled the zip tie, it broke. Then I had to find a way to open the dryer when I'm already late. I couldn't get it open. Finally did. Then I went into the bathroom to get ready and there's like a whole bunch of little ants. And I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? So killed all them. Then I'm like, great, now I'm gonna have to deal with these ants. Then doing my makeup and I dropped the top of my makeup that fit perfectly down the drain of the sink because it doesn't have a stopper right now. Because again, it's an old sink that needs to be replaced. And I was like, damn it. So then it has a stopper like a few inches down, but I had to try to fish it out. Everything I was doing was not working. And then finally, I thought a scissor would be too like wide to use it as a tong, but the scissor ended up being able to grab it and I pulled it out. And then there's still more. And then I bought like a little coffee thing because I don't have a kitchen yet because the kitchen needs to be renovated. So I got one of those little like gallon things. And so I poured it into a cup and I was about to like run out the door. And I can't drink black coffee because I'm a baby. I don't even drink coffee that much. And Mike and I definitely saved the creamer from our apartment because we checked the expiration date. It doesn't expire till like May or something ridiculous. And it's gone. We can't find it anywhere. We have no idea where this creamer is. It could be in the car somewhere. It's gone. But so then I couldn't have the coffee that I poured either. So just like a clusterfuck of a day. But that's how life really feels lately.
I feel like it's happening to me too. So the other day we turned on the TV and it's got these massive black lines down on it. So I feel like it's pretty, like it's old. So like I'm figuring it's like the LED or whatever. I don't know. Don't come at me technically, but something with the lighting. And then the other day our dryer fell off the wall.
Oh my God.
I'm like, what is going on? Like we've been in this house now for 3.5 years, I guess. So I guess things are bound to start happening, but oh my God, it just seems like it. And then my robot vacuum died, so I'm like, what is going on? My favorite appliance in the world died. I guess that's things, maybe that's it.
But even like Mike was saying the same thing about other things, just like so many little things are going wrong lately. Mm-hmm. And even my coworkers and I were looking up to see when it was a full moon what was going on, but it's not. I think we're all just tired. Everything is exhausting.
It's gonna get better. We're still gonna be positive.
Once we get out of quarter one, I think things will be looking up.
That might be a good opportunity for a car update.
Yeah.
So another week of non-updates. I thought this was going to be the week because he told me that there was going to be, this is the guy, the guest experience manager I've been dealing with. He told me that there was a management meeting on Monday at 11 o'clock and that he would call me straight after, or if he didn't call me that day, he would call me Tuesday. So just quickly in summary, Monday, 9 a.m., he gives me a call and he's like, hi, Olivia. I'm like, hi. He goes, I just wanted to ask you, where did you buy the car? And like my jaw just dropped. I was like, what? And this is in my head. I'm like, what? I said, I bought it from the dealership where you work, which is why this is the process that we've been going through. Like, I just was incredulous that he's asking me where, now, eight weeks in, where I bought the car. And he's like, oh, you bought it from here? I'm like, yes. Like, in my head, I'm like, why else would I be dealing with you? Like, yeah. If I could deal with someone else, I would be more than happy to.
Like, how did you wind up there then?
And then he goes, oh, well, could you please send me the sale contract? And I was like, I said yes. But in my head, I'm like, shouldn't you have that? This is your company. So anyway, I was expecting something because, you know, when he said management meeting, I'm like, finally things might be happening. So the latest update is he has sent me two emails since then. It is now Friday morning. He sent me two emails basically saying that he has forwarded some emails to the Australian dealership. So I'm like, so he did say in one email specifically he had forwarded the replacement request, which like he doesn't often use that terminology. So that was on Wednesday, I think, and I feel like that was some progress. He has just sent me another email this morning and the terminology was, hi, just letting you know I have sent a email. That's his wording, a email to I'll just find it quickly. Just advising you, I have forwarded a email to them today. Thank you for your patience.
What email? So,
anyway, so I did put in a complaint with the Department of Fair Trading, which is like the consumer protection government agency here. I did this a few weeks ago. They have gotten back to me today and they have asked for more information, which I feel is promising. Like they're not just saying no, basically. So they asked for information on the mechanical issues with the car, which I don't have. The company have never given it to us. They've never given us a diagnosis of what is actually wrong with the car. So we have called, my husband called the dealership while we were recording today and asked for that. So hopefully maybe that puts some fire under them. They would realize why we would want that. But I just did get this message on Instagram, which I totally agree with all this. The woman said, do not take that car back. They are trying to wear you down, which I 100% agree. I think
you were just saying that.
Yeah. So they rang me last week and said that the part was 2 weeks away. And that was what really made me rage because I've said I'm not having the car. But I feel like what their plan is just to fix the car and then hopefully just to wear me down and for me to take it back. She said, basically, what do you care if the Australian dealership has to get permission from the Asian dealership? That's their problem. You want the money now. Like she's basically telling me I need to be assertive, which I absolutely agree. I probably should be more assertive. She said, just call every single day, or if it's close enough, go down there. Your dealership can deal with getting their money. Too bad for them. Good luck.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah.
Even if they're like, the car is going to take 6 months to come, be like, all right, I'll wait.
And so when he rang me on Monday, that's why I thought things must really be happening, because he almost made it sound like they had a car that they were going to give me, because he's like, look, do you want the same color? Blah, blah, blah. And so I'm very flexible. I'm like, look, obviously I prefer the same color. If there's one that can come quicker, it's fine. All I want is the things that we've paid for to be included in the car, because, you know, you can have upgrades and stuff, you know, whatever. I said, I basically just want a like-for-like replacement of the car. And he's like, he goes to me, this is a very big thing, you know. And I'm like,
shut the fuck up.
So anyway, I just find it interesting their tactics, because essentially it is illegal for them to only offer me the repair of the car. So that's why I feel like they are just dragging this out and just hoping I'll be like, do you know what? This has gone on for too long. I'll just take the car.
Also, they're going to be like, it's a very big deal, you know, to ask for a replacement. They're lucky you and your kids didn't die.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then have a wrongful death lawsuit against them.
Yeah. One thing I am like has worked out a little bit in my favor is, so I was, after this all happened, it took them a week for them to offer us a replacement car. So to be fair, they did that off their own back. We didn't even ask for it because I had a car at work I could use, but I took the car because it was nicer than the work car. And I'm like, actually, I'm so glad I did that, because now at least I have that leverage over them. I'm like, I've got your car. Do you want it back?
Yeah.
At least that I feel like that is a cost. Like apparently the cost for that car, which I haven't paid anything in relation to this repair or the hire car, which so I shouldn't have. But another friend had to have a hire car through the same dealership when there was something wrong with her car, and they charged her $50 a day. Oh. So this is obviously like a cost. That wouldn't obviously be the cost to them anyway, but it's a cost that they probably don't want to have ongoing. So, yeah, fun times, non-update. I'm just like, at this point, it's just laughable. And then the other thing quickly too, I know I've carried on, but there was a registered post thing in the mailbox yesterday. So we went to the post office to get it. I thought it was going to be something fun. And what it was a registered post letter that we had to sign for from the car brand about an urgent vehicle recall. But what the recall was for a fuel sticker in the window.
Great.
Made a trip to the post office for a car that we don't have, and they could just replace themselves while it's in the service area at the dealership. It's just ridiculous.
I would have been pissed. Like, I hate going to the post office.
I know, and you always have to line up, and I thought it was going to be something good, and then it wasn't. Yeah, so. And the other thing is,
it's from who you're already mad at.
And then my husband also got an email the other day, and it's like, welcome to the family from the car.
No!
I'm like, either, so I was like, does that mean we're getting a new car? Because it's like your journey is about to begin. And I was like,
the journey better be almost over.
The journey began in December. So I'm like, either they're very late on their welcome emails or something might be happening. I feel like they're just very late.
And like, who is he asking what color you want? When then he's like, oh, well, I sent the email request to the company.
Oh my God. It's honestly a circus.
Gosh.
So fun times. At least I'm at the point of just laughing about it now, because what else can you do, really?
It really is, like, insanity.
Mm. So before we get into the episode, we're going to hear a word from our sponsor, Quince. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. They have 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. So the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. So by partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes, and we love that.
I got one of their Mongolian cashmere crew neck sweaters. I love it so much. It's super lightweight, but super cozy and soft and snuggly at the same time. It feels very luxurious, and I really love it. You could wear it so many different ways. It's super cute. And for the quality, I think it's super affordable, which, of course, we all love that. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/TCS for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/TCS to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/TCS. All right, what do we got? We got some other updates, though. We got some crime updates to talk about. So we got Sarah Sweeney. We talked about her death in the episode about the firefighter captain.
Grace Holland,
where he somehow has had two of his girlfriends die in his various homes. The first death with Grace, which is thought to be kind of suspicious, even though it was ruled a suicide. And then the most recent death was Sarah Sweeney. She was a doctor. She did have some medical issues, but she just randomly died somehow. So the update with that is the St. Louis County Medical Examiner did complete an autopsy report for her. This is like the recap from the article. She was found dead in the village of Westwood on the morning of January 13th. So the medical examiner listed her death as oxycodone, gabapentin, and diphenhydramine intoxication. And the manner of death was listed as undetermined. So, I mean, depending, I don't know if she was what she was prescribed, oxycodone obviously is a painkiller. Gabapentin is used either to treat epilepsy, but can also be used to treat nerve pain. So that could be related to her medical conditions. And then diphenhydramine is just the generic of Benadryl, so an antihistamine. I mean, it doesn't say, because the full report hasn't been released yet, so we can't see like how much was really in her system. Right? Like, that hasn't been mentioned as far as I've seen.
There's a lot of people who are very passionate and very involved in this case, and we've had some messages from some of them. I did ask them to send us the autopsy if when they get it, and they said they should have it shortly, but I don't think anyone has actually seen it yet.
Yeah, and that reminds me, this case, after we did this podcast, I didn't really – there's ones where when we record, I'm like, people are going to message us and be mean to us or argue with us about this one because it's kind of controversial. I didn't think that we would get as many, like, what's his name? Robert supporters as we did. Not that we got a ton, but I was still surprised.
One thing I do want to add is that there's one lady who's been messaging us on Facebook, and she has been very, not impartial, but very fair and balanced in the terms of the situation. And she has said that she knows a lot about the case and that basically in terms of Sarah's death, Robert was not around. He was on a 48-hour shift, I believe she told me, and that basically he has an alibi for this at the time of death anyway. Like, I know people have said, like, maybe he crushed it up. There are ways that he could have been involved if he was involved, but basically he wasn't at the house and it was proven that he wasn't there at the time that Sarah died.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to put that in just to be fair and, you know, give both sides of the story as well. But it still is an unusual case with both of them dying in a few years, within a few years of each other.
Grace, like, Sarah's death, I don't think really would have been side-eyed as much if it wasn't for Grace's death seeming like it could have been a cover-up.
I still think it's so weird how Sarah's attorney came out and basically said that she died of her illness. And then she didn't in the end, essentially.
Yeah, so I guess we will see what comes of that. But that is the latest update with that one. Did you want to talk about, the Lacey updates?
So the other case that there has been some movement in this week is the Lacey Overby abduction. Lacey did give another interview this week where she released some more information that we hadn't heard before. She basically spoke about the circumstances of the abduction. She said, I just left a pretty sad case. So Lacey is a nurse, if you remember. She said, I just left a pretty sad case. So I was kind of in my feels. I got tea and some tacos because I thought he'd need a warm meal. I called my daughter and told her I would take these tacos to this guy and then I was headed home. So this is the first bit that's kind of a little bit of an inconsistency because in some reports she said he was homeless, but in another one she said he wasn't, but now he's apparently back to being homeless. She said that the man and her got into an altercation when she tried to give him the food. And this is her explanation for how he got into the car. She said, when I handed them to him, before I knew it, he had his arm through the window and he pushed my gear stick into park. When that happens, all of my doors unlock. It happened within 5 to 10 seconds. He got in the back seat and said, drive. So Lacey has also spoken about, like, the man seemed to have been kind of working for someone. She said he had two different phones and I overheard him talking to someone like he's in trouble, like a boss that was screaming at him. You could sense that his body movements and stuff had changed. She said that they stopped a few times, which she's always said. Once was for gas. She said she even tried to crash into a police car at one point to bring attention to the fact that she was being abducted. When they asked her why she didn't run away, Lacey said that she didn't want to risk her family getting hurt. She also said, I asked to go to the bathroom at one point and he gave me my daughter's sweatshirt to put under me and urinate on. He had my address and debit card, which has a picture of my family on it. He kept patting it in his shirt and I was terrified. If someone has your information and pictures of your children, you won't drive away either. So in this interview, Lacey had some Ziploc bags. We've got the whole clip on our Instagram and Facebook pages if you want to check it out. But she's got Ziploc bags, which were the scrubs and this gauze apparently that was used in the abduction. She said the police have never taken that for investigation. She said that the man strangled her with his gauze, which had some blood on it in the interview, and that he sexually assaulted her. She said, I met his eyes in my rearview mirror, and that's the last thing I remember. I woke up outside the car and he dragged me behind the car to a grassy area and he sexually assaulted me. So after all this happened and we posted the interview on our Instagram and Facebook, Lacey actually started commenting on our Facebook page. Basically, she went on there and she was asking to set the record straight and she was asking for people to contact her and even meet up with her, which I feel is very strange behavior for someone who has been abducted and kidnapped.
Because she's arguing with people on our Facebook and other accounts, I'm sure, in any time. Like, she'll answer some questions, but then she'll just be like, reach out to me directly, email me or message me or we can meet up or something. Where it's like, if you really want to get your story out there correctly, why aren't you just type up one big thing, post it? Yeah. Like, why are you telling people individually to contact you?
So we asked her when she was commenting if she had a picture of a sketch of the suspect that we could share, and she said she's never been asked to do one. And then someone else said to her, why don't you write up the whole story and we can release it? And she said she's in the process of doing that, but we haven't had anything come in yet. So someone's asking her basically why she's doubling down now. She wrote, I never doubled down. Different social media platforms change the stories. Please reach out if you want my story, not one that has been changed over and over depending on who said it. So basically this, she went on for a little while on the page. She said, so someone said, did the police find any evidence on the backseat of your car? She said, that's the funny part. Laredo only fingerprinted the outside. They even left the gauze with my blood on it for my daughter to drive back in with. Didn't even take my urine and bloody scrubs. I have them still. So Lacey in the comments on our Facebook page was saying that she underwent a sane exam in terms of her being sexually assaulted by the abductor. Someone wrote to us on our Instagram and they said, I am a sexual assault nurse and as a sane exam does not prove anything. I'm not commenting on her case, but doctors and nurses deal with medical findings, not providing a sex assault happened. Our findings can be consistent with the report of the victim, but ultimately our exams don't prove anything except for physical and sexual contact. Sorry. So Lacey apparently sought out this exam to have herself, but it wasn't maybe the correct type of exam to prove sexual assault is what I've gotten from that.
I think it's more so they can't, like the doctor or whoever, the medical practice isn't going to be like, yes, you were sexually assaulted. They just give the results. And then like if there is a trial or a police investigation, you can be like, these are the results of this test that I took and they match with the story I'm saying that there was sexual activity, which was assault. You know what I mean? Like the doctor's not going to be like, yes, this was sexual assault because they can't tell from a medical exam if there was like consent or not.
One other kind of interesting comment that I found on the Facebook page was that apparently after she was abducted a few weeks later, Lacey went on a cruise to Mexico. Someone wrote, which, you know, obviously we're not condoning being mean to victims or whatever, but this is part of the conversation. I just find it interesting. So someone wrote, you were so brave to go on that Mexican cruise just weeks after being nearly kidnapped across the border. And then she wrote, again, you have neglected to say how my story changed, but that's okay. I'm done feeding trolls. Have a blessed day with your fake profile. Then she asks again for that person to contact her. And the person who wrote that about the cruise wrote, it's weird that you want to meet strangers to message you and meet with you. You've given two interviews and made a Facebook post about your experience and it's changed every single time. What were the toxicology results? She said, if you don't want the correct story, keep my name out of your mouth. My story has not changed one bit. Like I said, what parts changed? You can't even answer that. And where did you get the cruise information? And then the person wrote again, it's on your boyfriend's Facebook page. So I have the video of the cruise. I don't know of the dates they were on it, though. She was on it at least on March the 1st, which was basically a month after her abduction. Apparently her and her boyfriend got engaged on the cruise. It just seems like very weird behavior for someone who was discussing how unsafe Mexico is and something needs to be done about, you know, the border and all the issues that she raised in her initial statements. It just seems like weird behavior that she almost tried to deny until she realized it was on her boyfriend's Facebook page.
I also thought it was interesting, the one you sent me before, how people are talking about it and whoever on our True Crime Society account said that she was found trying to cross the border and she responded to that comment being like, I wasn't trying to cross the border. But it's like, she's the one who said that, is it not? Yeah. In the actual interview of her speaking.
I think part of it too was in the initial articles, it's like she was found at the border, like, you know, in line to cross the border. So I don't know. We've had messages too that there's a whole bunch of other inconsistencies. Like obviously it could still be true and maybe she's just confused about what happened. She'd release a whole massive statement as well. I'm not going to read it because basically it goes into that she's
like roasting truthful. The police department basically.
Yeah. She says, like, all of you saying I faked this for all the observed reasons. Wake up, people. Protect your babies, kids, friends, parents, anyone else you care about. That's weird. And we had some people ask us when we've been posting about this what would be her motivation to make it up. If she did make it up, obviously, there could be a bunch of reasons. Could be monetary. There was a fundraiser after. It could be political when she talked about not making it political but then spoke about Biden and everything. Or the other thing
there is
could be mental
no
health.
Real reason.
Yeah. Could just be mental health and attention seeking or – I don't know. There could be a multitude of reasons. It doesn't have to be one specific reason. There are plenty of reasons that it could be.
I've been in the camp of, I think that this isn't truthful. I don't know to what extent, but I think that there are definitely some lies. But then I was thinking, like, why is she doubling down? If she just, like, wasn't bringing this up anymore, people would have forgotten about this by now.
Yeah.
Most people anyways. Like, people like us, we'd still be like, oh, did anything else ever happen with that? But for the most part, most people would have moved on. People would have stopped bothering her.
I just feel like with her life. If you were traumatized by an incident,
you'd want
like,
to
I understand
go away.
And it would be frustrating to not be believed and for the police apparently not to do an investigation, but then surely you would just either get one statement out through a lawyer or whatever and try and move on, because what else can there be?
And then it just had me wondering, because then this is the first time she said that she was sexually assaulted, and I never want to be someone to not believe someone about sexual assault or, you know, anything really. Like, I'm very believe women, but sometimes we've seen many people who lie about these things and fake things like that. And it sucks because then it kind of discredits every woman who is telling the truth and puts doubt in people's minds when women are telling the truth. But then, so anyways, the point is I was thinking about more and I'm like, maybe something happened and then she fabricated the story maybe, or just made it something much bigger than it was. And that's why she's kind of like doubling down now. So maybe like something happened, but so much about the story just doesn't make sense. And it does change every time she tells it, no matter what she says.
And we've had some people message us saying, why don't some people believe her? There's like actually no proof that we know of. There's no CCTV of her. The only CCTV there is her buying the tacos. There's no CCTV of the man anywhere along this 6-hour journey. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's just nothing. She's saying that there was evidence in the car. Maybe that's true. We don't know. But
and the police have said nothing.
Yeah. Nothing. And that's not totally true. The DeSoto police have said there's no threat to the public. So they haven't confirmed anything, and there's never been a manhunt for the abductor. Do you know what? Maybe it will turn out that the police have done a really shitty job, but it could also very well go the other way.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm interested to see what happens or what the police are going to do. Because the very long statement she wrote was basically directed at them, like not doing their job properly on their page.
Yeah.
So we shall see. I feel like the news isn't even going to keep covering it after a while. No.
Well, and one other thing too, I feel like I could talk about this case for a while. Other thing I found interesting was she's done a few interviews with the media, and not this most recent one, but possibly the one before where she spoke to a news agency. She didn't want them to use her name or show her face. But in the most recent one, her name and face are out there. She's like, it's a full camera shot of her sitting
there.
She's
in full glam.
So she's changed her mind. Oh, yeah. And then she also wears scrubs. People are like, why is she wearing scrubs in the interview? Like, so many questions.
Yeah. So overall, just strange behavior. A lot of stuff doesn't add up. Who's to say what really happened at this point? But we will keep an eye out. So
if we ever
like
know,
I said, I'll try. If anything does happen, I'll try to put in a clip. I don't know if there will be clips. So just keep following us on Instagram, because that is where we post. There's also a lot of chat about this one. In our Facebook group, our Facebook page is what she's commenting on if you want to go see that.
Before we finish up with the episode, we're going to hear a word from our sponsor, IQ Bar. I have been loving IQ Bars lately. I just love that they're so easy to grab if you don't have time in the morning. You know, sometimes you don't grab something and then you end up eating junk or something that you're going to regret later. With IQ Bar, I love that you can just grab one, eat it at work, eat it on the run, and they are so, so delicious. My favorite one at the moment is the peanut butter chip IQ Bar. It's just like almost tastes like a treat. It's so delicious, but it's so good for you.
That's my favorite one too. It's so good.
Start each day right with IQ Bars, brain and body boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. Their ultimate sampler pack includes all three. You get 7 IQ Bar flavors, 4 IQ Mix flavors, and 4 IQ Joe flavors. And today our listeners get an exclusive offer of 20% off plus free shipping. Just text CRIME to 64,000.
Whether you're running a marathon or running errands, IQ Bar empowers doers with superior brain and body nutrition. Their plant protein bars are packed with high-quality ingredients to keep you physically and mentally fit. IQ Bars are vegan, gluten-free, and low in sugar and carbs. And every flavor is absolutely delish. IQ Bar makes the number one brain and body nutrition bar, hydration mix, and instant coffee in the U.S. There's over 10,000 five-star reviews and counting. Refuel smarter with IQ Bar's ultimate sampler pack. That's 7 IQ Bars, 4 IQ Mix Sticks, and 4 IQ Joe Sticks. And now our special podcast listeners get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, just text CRIME to 64,000. Get your discount, text CRIME to 64,000. That's CRIME to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Okay, so we will get into the topic at hand. So today we're going to talk about the deaths of two entire families at the hands of the mother. One of these happened this month, so very recently, and it was similar to one that happened a few years ago. So we're going to get into those.
Last month, doesn't matter.
Oh, yeah. No, it happened in February. It's March now. So, yeah, we're going to get into those. They're both moms who killed their children with arson, burning the house down.
I am so very sorry for the heartache she was feeling. I'm so very sorry for the children. I'm so very, very sorry for the parents.
You could see the heartbreak and sadness in Councilwoman Linda Lifka's eyes. She's just one of many in Ferguson and all around the St. Louis region, still feeling the pain after hearing about Monday's house fire that killed Bernadine Birdie Prusner and her four children. Fire investigators now say the 39-year-old mom intentionally set the fire, which started on the mattress. The Ferguson mom was a former model, a highly respected author, and assistant professor who taught early childhood education at Lewis and Clark Community College.
For somebody to have that much outreach and that much connection with humanity all around her, to feel that alone, we need to do better.
St. Louis County Police say she left a note stating intentions to take her life and the lives of her children. 2-year-old Millie, 6-year-old Jackson, and her 9-year-old twin daughters, Ellie and Ivy.
Okay, so the first one we're going to talk about is the case of Birdie Prusner. She killed her 4 children. She set their house on fire with all of them in it in February 2024. So some background into her. Her real name is Bernadine Prusner, but she goes by Birdie, so we will call her that. She's 39 at the time of this incident, and she had 4 children. She had twin 9-year-old daughters named Ivy and Lily, and 2 other children, 5-year-old Jackson, and then a 2-year-old named Millie. Yeah, so the twins have one dad. Their last name is Prusner. The other 2 children, they have a different dad. Their last name is Spader. So Birdie has an online bio.
She's really, like, this is one case I feel like in the group where so many people are like, wow, I knew her, mainly online, but she was very big in, like, parenting and child
Montessori
education. Yeah, so she was very well, not well, I don't know if well known, but a lot of people seem to have come across her in parenting groups online especially.
So it says Birdie is an author, educator, urban farmer, and mother of 4. She's been sharing advice with parents and caregivers about healthy eating habits, the Montessori method, and inviting kids into the kitchen for over 10 years. She's lived in St. Louis County most of her life, first in being home for the last 5 years. So she was a doctoral student. She already had her master's in early childhood education. The list goes on and on. She has tons of degrees, qualified M-O-D-E-S-E teacher. Sorry if like you pronounce that a certain way. I'm not positive. Certified to teach agriculture, just a lot of things.
One thing I found interesting, that was 1 year she was the recipient of the Missouri Teacher of the Year Award. So like she was very involved in her children's education and I guess just child education and development in general.
And another interesting thing, it says a quote close to Birdie's heart is from Maria Montessori. It says, "There must be provision for the child to have contact with nature, to understand and appreciate the order, the harmony, and the beauty in nature, that the child may better understand and participate in the marvelous things which civilization creates." A relative of hers named Tyler Justice said her smile would light up the room. She was just one of those people that if you were in a bad mood and you talked to her, she would make you feel a lot better. Tyler also spoke about Birdie's children. He said, "They were some of the smartest, brightest kids you could have and full of life just like she was." Birdie conceived at least 2 of her children with the help of IVF. There's a Facebook post that she made to Share Institutes and says, "Dr. Share, Jamie, Mary Kay, they're here. I'll bring them by soon, but wanted to let you know. First time success, beautiful, healthy twins, twin girls. Thanks for helping us build our family." And has a picture of the 2 twins as babies with those pink and blue striped blankets in the hospital. So she has 2 Facebook accounts, with the most recent being under the name Birdie Dorville.
So her new Facebook page is still up. It only goes back to, I think, September or something like September last year, but it's basically full of, you know, parenting quotes. There's one from January 29th that says, when you go through the hardest times, the people that come to your aid are the ones that you will carry with you forever. The people that don't, no matter how close you perceive them to be, should not be part of your inner circle. Pain and hardships help highlight who is, who has, and will always be there for you through the roller coaster of life. So a lot of it was kind of, you know, motivational and inspirational. This one's from February 16th. She's posted a meme and it says, you never truly know the depths of what a person may be going through, what their heart may be grieving, what their soul may be carrying, what their body may be carrying, what their soul may be longing for. So stay kind-hearted and open-minded. For some, maybe where they're in major storms just beneath skin.
I saw people saying on Reddit when I was reading about it, that when they saw that quote, that like when they heard the news of the fire that killed the family, when people saw that quote post, they were like, I knew that she did it.
Yeah, so the fire did happen on February 19th, and this is right around the time that she started making posts. So it's hard for me to tell because of the time zones, but it says February 18th, so I'm assuming that was probably February 17th for her. She updated the photo to be her and her four kids, like beautiful photogenic family standing there smiling. She writes, then these are the last few posts on her page. Making today one of those live each day like it's your last kind of days. Breakfast, reptile show, soccer game, and living room camp out on the agenda, plus whatever shenanigans bring us joy. Happy Sunday. Thank God the sun is shining. The next one, which she posted about 12 hours later, right before the fire, I believe, it says, us against the world, I'm so blessed to be their mama. They have a heart for the Lord and have overcome so much more in their little lives than they should have had to face. And the very last post, which is around 2 hours after that, she wrote, all my kids peacefully sleeping in my bed, curled up together, knowing they are loved so fiercely that I'd do absolutely anything for them. This is my favorite moment.
Some people have speculated that they think that the kids were already dead at that point.
I feel like they weren't dead because they will get into how they die, but I suspect they may have been drugged. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I meant, like drugged or incapacitated in some sense.
There is one other post I found online where Birdie kind of starts talking about the legal and custody issues that she was having. She commented on a post and she said, I wish we could venture further. My ex lives in St. Louis, so I am tethered here in order to co-parent our kiddos. So the person writes, you might be able to get an exemption. Not all judges will agree. And then Birdie says, I have tried several times. I can't be driving 4 hours a day to get them to school, so I need to find something closer.
In regards to that, there is a court case pending between Birdie and her ex, which is the father of the twins. So this was a comment that we found online that kind of explained what was going on. It says, it's all the activity related to an open case where it appears the mother was seeking to increase child support for the twins. There are a lot of documents embedded throughout. It does appear that the case was getting uglier as time progressed. There are some interesting allegations about Birdie's mother being a nutcase by admission of Birdie during original custody proceedings. And recently, Birdie was apparently trying to backtrack some of these because their original arrangements required that the twins not be allowed visitation with that grandmother. But Birdie recently moved back into a house owned by her mother, to which the father was objecting. Lots to unpack here. So basically, we don't know the whole backstory, but there was an order of protection against Birdie's mother, the grandmother, for whatever reason. The dad didn't want the kids around her mother, but then Birdie was wanting to move back or moved into and was wanting to move back into a house that was owned by the mother with the mother, and the father was objecting that. So this is some more information about that court battle from the New York Post. It says Birdie and her ex, David, divorced in 2017 and shared joint custody of Ivy and Ellie through last year when the father filed to block Birdie's plans to relocate about 10 miles away to the St. Louis suburbs of Creve-Cur, according to court records. Even though the new home would be closer to him, David was concerned about his ex-wife's proximity to her mother, whom she had allegedly described as psychotic in the past. Birdie's lawyer, Nathan Cohen, told the Post, the first case that I've ever had where the parent objected to the other parent moving closer to the other parent. Birdie was also facing a custody battle with her other ex-boyfriend, David Spader. He's the father of the other two children, Jackson and Millie. Her lawyer said David and Jared coordinated their efforts. So there's also some information online about a protection order in the case. These are some comments on social media. Someone wrote, okay, I found out what the protection order is about. Birdie filed with the court to be able to obtain and hold passports for the children without the dad's consent. Dad fought that. Birdie's request was denied, and she was ordered to abide by the agreements in the parenting plan. She filed for a temporary restraining order over this. The father filed an injunction to that. Then Dad filed a restraining order against her, filed with the court to compel Birdie to produce documentation, and filed for a preliminary injunction requiring supervised visitation. She filed to replace her attorneys a couple different times, and the stuff Dad filed is a continuing thing. There is a judgment against her from one of the attorneys she replaced for unpaid fees. She was ordered to pay them over $5,000, and they executed garnishing her wages.
There's so much legal thing, you know, legal stuff going on for her. It would have been, like, not obviously excusing what she did, but it would be a lot, very stressful and very expensive.
So Birdie did seem to have a big online presence in parenting groups, like we had mentioned. One member of our Facebook group knew her online. They said, the kids have two different dads. I know the twins' dad has put her through tons of court proceedings over the years. On February 19th, 2024, there was a fire at Birdie's home in Ferguson, Missouri. A neighbor said he woke up at 4:30 a.m. and saw the glow of the flames through his window. The neighbor said he ran to the house and banged on the door to try to wake the family while his wife called 911.
We are following breaking news at noon. Five people are dead following a house fire in Ferguson. Right now, investigators are there looking for the cause of that fire. Thanks for joining us at noon. I'm Kay Quinn. Crews responded to the burning home just before 4:30 this morning on North Clay. We're told the intensity of the flames kept firefighters from fully attacking the fire. Five on Your Side's Diamond Palmer is on scene. And Diamond, you're getting some information from family members?
Well, Kay, just moments ago, we were able to speak to the victim's family, and they confirmed to us a mother and four of her children were inside of the home at the time of the fire. And that family tells us that the youngest child was 3 years old. Now, St. Louis County Police tell us around 4:30 this morning, Ferguson police officers responded to a house fire in the 500 block of North Clay Avenue. Police initially found four people dead inside of the home, and then a short time after that, they found a fifth person dead, and as well as a dog dead inside of the home. Now, the City of Ferguson's Police Department has requested the St. Louis County Bureau of Crimes Against Persons to lead the investigation.
We don't really know the circumstances of what occurred here, but we are investigating. We've got our bomb and arson unit out here, our regional unit out here investigating. We've got our Crimes Against Persons Bureau investigating, as well as our crime scene unit. And then several other fire agencies are on scene still making sure that the house is clear for people to enter and search for any evidence.
Again, St. Louis County Police tell us that bomb and arson squad are on the scene to investigate this, and they do tell us that family members are concerned as well, and they're continuing to show up here on the scene. We'll continue to keep you updated here on this breaking news. Reporting live here in Ferguson, Diamond Palmer, 5 on Your Side.
So this is a neighbor speaking about the fire. She said, it felt like my heart just fell to the bottom of my stomach, and all I could really do was just pray. There's no smoke detectors going off during the fire. Firefighters from four municipalities were called to combat the blaze, which was so powerful they had to back down several times. There's rumors online that the doors had been barricaded from the inside, making it even harder for first responders to gain access. Going out in this way is extra shitty because look at how many other people's lives are being put at risk to try to get in there to save these kids and her.
Yeah.
That she was killing / didn't want to be saved. These are some comments online. Someone said, there are videos of news coverage all over YouTube. I hope they're exaggerating or mistaken when they reported it took firefighters 2 hours to make entry. And someone responded and said, my friend said it took 2 hours because of the amount of gasoline used. I kind of brushed over it because I thought she was exaggerating. So nobody in the house was able to survive the fire. Birdie and her four children all passed away. Three of the family dogs had also passed away. An animal rescue organization was able to rescue 11 rabbits and 2 cats. As news of the fire broke, people online started pointing fingers at Birdie's ex-partners. So there's just comments of people talking about it, and someone said, they reported the twins' father as possible suspect, ongoing custody battle, and possible restraining order against him beyond sad. So neighbors said that at first they didn't think anyone was in the home when it caught fire, as Bertie's van wasn't parked in the driveway. St. Louis Police Department quickly called the fire suspicious and launched an investigation. The St. Louis County Police spokesperson Tracy Panis said, "We don't really know the circumstances of what occurred here, but we are investigating." Bertie and her children all died from smoke inhalation.
So just a few days after the fire on February 22nd, it was announced that this was a murder-suicide and that Bertie had intentionally lit the fire that killed her and her children. The police sergeant Tracy Panis said in an email that it was believed that Bertie set fire to a mattress. They also said a note was left stating Bertie's intentions to take her life and the lives of her children, and the note had been left in the minivan. Chief Troy Doyle of the Ferguson Police released a statement, and this is an excerpt from that. He said, "The first responders met with a situation that no training manual could ever prepare them for. It was a stark reminder of the unseen battles some of our neighbours are fighting and the critical need for empathy, compassion and support from all of us. The incident has profoundly affected those who served that day, showcasing the vulnerability that we all share as human beings. In honouring Bertie and her children, let's pledge to forge a community that's not just safe, but deeply connected, where every person feels valued and heard. It's time for us to come together to support each other and to heal as one." So there was a GoFundMe made in this case. The fundraising goal was $20,000. They have raised $17,000, and I believe that it was to fund the funerals of the family. They did post an update on there, which kind of gave some more information about Bertie and her state of mind.
Also kind of a crazy statement.
Yeah. "Tragically, the life of a wonderful mother and brilliant educator and her four children were lost this week. They want to share with you," and the statement is on behalf of Bertie's family, so that is who they is. "They want to share with you that their daughter was happy, enjoyed life, was a success in all endeavors, including her career and as a professor in early education. She excelled most in her compassion and care for her children. Bertie lived for her children and focused only on their happiness. Bertie got to an awful place, one that resulted in tragic consequences. The family wants you to know that she got to that darkness as a result of spurious litigation and unfounded allegations by her ex-husband and ex-boyfriend. When Bertie requested to relocate closer to the ex-husband as her younger children became school age, her ex-husband filed a motion to prevent relocation. Her boyfriend, who had not even established legal rights to the children, joined the husband to prevent relocation. Along with those motions, allegations and requests to change or diminish Bertie's capacity as a woman and a mother ensued. She saw her children being used by their fathers as foils, and she viewed the process and system for resolutions as cumbersome, tedious, and never-ending. Each day that Bertie would score a step forward, her ex-husband and the boyfriend would undertake an action to denigrate or undermine her role as a mother. It says her ex-husband and former boyfriend were well-funded by their incomes when it came to a no-holds-barred attack on Bertie. Bertie's spirit succumbed to the inexorably demeaning process. She saw her children slowly and steadily suffering. She viewed the children as being used by their fathers. Tragically, she made the wrong choice. She was fiercely independent, rejecting our support and only accepting our love." They go on to say, "The family believes that Bertie would never have gotten to this place without the unending attacks on her by her ex-husband and ex-boyfriend. We wish that they would have reached out and received help. We hope that Bertie's untimely death can be a reminder that even the strongest of us can use help in the moments of crisis." They then go on to thank all the first responders, but it's a controversial statement, you know, obviously based on what Bertie ended up doing, that she only lived for her children and that she did this out of love, essentially.
Yeah, it's just like, it's so hard to comment on these cases and situation, especially, I mean, I guess postpartum depression can go up to like 3 years or longer, and her youngest one was 2, but I don't think this was anything like that necessarily. But again, who am I to comment on someone else's mental health when we really don't know the whole story? But all that is just a preface saying I feel like it's very easy to always take the side of the mother as the victim in some sense and blame the fathers and say, like, oh, they're pieces of shit. Like, look what they were doing. You know, like, I think that's generally how it goes. But I do think it's interesting here that both of the exes teamed up together to fight for their kids. I just feel like it goes to show that there was some reason that they were putting in all this effort to try to help the kids or keep the kids away from the grandmother, Because if they really just didn't like Birdie to an extent, like, would they go through all this effort, all this money, getting lawyers? I know some people do, because I know people like that in life. But it's interesting that they teamed up together. So I do just think there's more to the story, and it wasn't so much just them, like, bullying her, which is what it seems like the family Make wants people to believe. Obviously, there's three sides to every story, so.
So Birdie's lawyer, Nathan Cohen, has made a statement too, saying that he was shocked and that he never believed Birdie would be a danger to herself or her children. He told the New York Post, "It's really strange. This entire week I've been asking my staff, did I miss it? She was one of the rare clients you get in family law that is not only upbeat, but was not putting on a show." He said, "Last week, the ex-husband pulled another move. The last thing I said to her was, don't worry, Birdie, we'll kick this one down too. Apparently, I missed every sign." So Jared, who is the father of two of the children, also released a statement on behalf of himself and David, who was the ex-husband. He said, "What I would want everyone to know about my two wonderful children is they are the greatest gift that a father could ever ask for. Jackson was the most incredible older brother, kind, intuitive, and gentle. He loved his sisters, being outside, sports and art, and he was so in tune with the needs of others. Millie was funny, charismatic, and sweet, and a kind little sister who brightened every moment of every day for us. They were the two most beautiful souls that a father could ask for, and they were a gift to our lives in every way. As dads right now, we have to focus on honoring these four beautiful lives, and we plan to do that together. Our thanks go out to the community, people we know, and people we've never met who have shown us incredible amounts of support. We will continue to need it." So the family have asked that instead of flowers, people donate to the St. Louis Regional Critical Incident Stress Management Team for first responders. And Jared has said that he is grateful to the responders and noted that some of them still call him every single day to check in. So just one point of discussion that I have for this case is how she said that they were having the lounge room sleepover all together on her Facebook page, and that how she actually set the fire was that she set a mattress on fire in the living room. So mm-hmm. I'm assuming that was probably a bed that they were all sleeping on or near, at least. So it's a very sad way to die. Like, you know, we're all having a sleepover in the lounge room, and then for her to set the mattress on fire is crazy.
Yeah, that's very sad. I saved a couple comments just because when I was reading today, there are just a lot of polar opposite opinions on this one. Obviously, they're the ones that are like so sad that she felt like this was her only way out. Like this was the only way that she felt like she could, like she couldn't get any help. And this was the only thing that she could do. But then there's just as many comments saying things like, apparently she hated her exes more than she loved her kids. Someone else said, "Sounds to me like the fathers knew their children were in harm's way. Anyone who still says she's a nice person was played like a fool. It's called a manipulative narcissist. The courts failed those children, and I hope the counselor and judge never forget this." Someone else said, "It's pretty unreal blaming people who didn't murder their kids. Whoever made that GoFundMe, just wow."
I did find it interesting because in our group they posted about it as it happened and before we knew that it was a murder suicide, and there were people in there who knew Birdie and they're like, absolutely, she would never do this, this is the ex did this, or it's an accident. They're like, there is no way this was a murder suicide. And even when it came out that it was, there are still people like, nope, absolutely not, you know, this is not what she would do. But even her family have acknowledged that it seems like she did do it.
Yeah, I mean, you never know if she just had some sort of like psychotic break or if this was like a very planned manipulative thing where maybe she felt like there was a chance of her losing some custody or something, and it was the, well, if I can't have them, like I'm not sharing them, no one's having them type of thing. We say this when it's flipped, because a lot of times in like family annihilator situations it's usually the man, and people will be like, oh, like I would have never guessed. He was very nice. Or in domestic abuse situations, people say the abuser is so nice. He's outgoing, charismatic. But just saying, like, it just goes to show that what someone puts out there publicly might not really be how they are all the time, or you don't know how they are behind closed doors or what they're struggling with. So even though people are saying like, oh, wow, she's this amazing person, she's so nice and kind and all that, it kind of goes back to the quote that she posted of like, you don't really know what someone's dealing with in their private life.
Yeah.
And just another, again, I don't know if this relates to her. Anything I'm saying, I'm just like thinking out loud, really. I don't want anyone to like get offended or mad. But another thing I was thinking about, kind of how children are basically like her brand, her identity. She is highly educated, so it's not like she's just like some family blogger.
No offense to family bloggers.
No, I was thinking more of like Ruby was what I was thinking about it, of how like she kind of just like used her kids in that sense. Whereas I wonder if with all this custody stuff going on, maybe something else was going to happen where it wouldn't really, in her mind, wouldn't look great for her brand, like if her children were taken away or something like that happened, you know?
I did find that comment you said interesting about, I'm paraphrasing, but how she hated the ex more than she loved the children. Like,
yeah.
I feel like anyone, even if you had to share custody, at least you're alive and you can see them. Like, I just feel like this was, it was a very selfish act. Like, I don't know, people might come at me for that, but it absolutely was. It was, if you can't have them, if I can't have them 100%, no one is going to have them.
Yeah, I think it was very much proving a point, whether it was like kind of an impulsive decision or not. But I agree. I do think it was very selfish. And whether she was an amazing person in her life or not, this was a really horrible, horrible thing to do. And I think it should wipe out a lot of people being like, no, she was amazing.
I agree.
So, and it's sad that we have to be scared to say that, because I do feel like people are going to be mad about it. And I'm not saying like she wasn't a good person,
and I understand she was probably driven by desperation, but essentially she made a choice and it was absolutely the wrong choice. She should not, there is no excuse for this behavior or these murders. It should not have happened. And, you know, again, that goes back to support that she received. You know, that's a whole other discussion about, did she get the right support? Did she have access to it? We don't know. But like, I know there's a whole bunch of things that can be discussed, but essentially what it comes down to is her making the choice, and she is the only one who can take responsibility for that.
Yeah.
All right. So the second case we're going to discuss is actually an Australian one out of Canberra. So it's from February 2018. Interesting, they both happened in February.
Mm.
The woman involved in this case is Anne Wachera Muharo. She killed her children, 8-year-old Esven Mujera and 5-year-old Furaha Muharo, before starting a fire in their home and taking her own life. Anne had been described by her family and friends as intelligent, resolute, very determined. And they also said that she had a strong Christian faith and believed in using prayer to help solve her problems. Up to the murders, friends said Anne had lost a lot of weight and she seemed aloof and depressed in the month leading up to it. And she spent most of her time either working from home or on leave. As some background into Anne's relationship with the children's father, he's not named in any of the documents besides his name being Mr. Munneen. I believe, though, his name was George. I've seen that in some other articles online. She met George on a trip to Kenya in 2005. She then sponsored his visa application for travel to Australia, and they were married in Canberra in February 2007. The relationship was very volatile. They broke up and got back together a number of times. Anne apparently did not believe in divorce due to her religious beliefs. There's an inquest document online, which I've linked in the blog if you want to read the whole thing. It's quite comprehensive and it goes into a lot of detail. This is just an excerpt of it. It says there are a number of allegations of family violence between George and Anne. An interim domestic violence order was applied for and obtained. Basically, that Anne alleged that George threatened to commit suicide if the domestic violence order was not withdrawn, and that's why she withdrew it in the first place. She alleged that he was violent during the course of their relationship. She alleged that he had threatened to take and kill one of the children and burn down the house, and that basically, like, this was just all ongoing. It was a very toxic back and forth relationship. Though, so they split up. I don't know if they ever got divorced, but they were split. And by 2012, George had been given supervised contact with both children. In May 2013, the family court made an order by consent between Anne and George and gave Anne sole parental responsibility for the children. George was permitted to communicate on specific days and times, and he was granted both supervised and unsupervised visits. Anne's friends have said that she withdrew from the Kenyan community in Canberra due to her fear of George. She grew distrustful of other people in case they were friends with George. You know, they'd report back what she was doing. So she kind of really, really withdrew from her friends and her support group. In August 2015, during an unsupervised visit with George, one of the children fell and broke her arm. Anne notified police and insinuated that George had assaulted the child. She also accused George of trying to burn the house down at that time and steal the children. George was investigated and cleared, and the injury was determined to be an accident. So the back and forth continued for years and years. Like, this must have been exhausting for both of them. By November 2017, Anne was refusing to give George any access to the children. The last time he saw them was the 21st of October 2017. In December 2017, George filed a notice of risk in the family court. He asked for shared parental responsibility, and the matter was scheduled to be heard in court on February 19th, 2018. I actually think it's the exact same date. That's crazy.
Yeah.
February 19th, just a few years apart.
Yeah, it is. Weird.
Anne's friends have said that from February 11th, 2018, so around a week before what it all happened, she seemed like she'd become happier, she was joking, she was more relaxed and at peace, and they remarked that her behavior was out of character and unusually happy. They said that she didn't display any of her usual anxiety about the upcoming court proceedings. On February 16th, Anne made a will, so that's 3 days before. Basically, she appointed a guardian of any child of hers at the time of her death, and that she gave them each $5,000 if the children survived her.
Hmm.
On February 17th, Anne took the kids to Kmart to buy some fun toys for them. Friends and family have said that Anne usually only purchased educational toys and that this seemed to be out of character. Anne also dropped off a bag of documents to her pastor on that day. The pastor said he kept the bag sealed, but he believed that the documents were ones that needed to be kept safe. Later that day, after returning home, Anne called her mother in Kenya. Anne's mother said that the call wasn't placed at a convenient time for her, but Anne insisted that she speak with the grandchildren, and this was the last time the children were heard or seen. There was a Samsung tablet found in the home, and the last activity on it was recorded as occurring at 8:56 a.m. on the 18th of February, which indicates that was the last time it was used. The device was restricted to child mode and had apps for games and education on it. Computer records show that at around 3:37 a.m. on the 19th of February, Anne powered up and entered the password on her laptop. From then until 3 a.m., she used her laptop to access her work computer, and she erased all her workplace computer files, and police were not able to recover them. She then logged onto her bank account and paid a number of bills before logging off and powering down the laptop at 3:53 a.m. At 8:45 a.m. that day, so just a few hours later, fire and rescue responded to reports of a fire at Anne's property. The bodies of Anne and her children were found inside. The autopsies determined that Anne died from the effects of fire, which was inhalation of products of combustion and burns. However, the causes of death for the two children were unable to be determined. The professor who conducted the autopsy said this about the deaths of the children: "I am unable to exclude possibilities such as more subtle forms of neck compression and a blockage of the oral and nasal orifices as a result of suffocation or smothering. I emphasize there is no specific evidence for such mechanisms in these cases. No pathological features would be seen in such cases. This would especially be the case in the setting of fire with burns to the body, which could mask injuries." So it's never, ever been confirmed, basically, if the children were dead before the fire or if they died as a result of it.
Either way, what a shit way to go.
So Anne, the inquest document goes into detail about how they were all found. Anne was found in the main bedroom of the house, and she was found on the floor. Esven was found in another bedroom. He was laying on his back in bed, holding a stuffed toy in his hands. The fire in his room had been limited to the areas of the bed and the wardrobe. Furaha was found in another bedroom. She was also in her bed, holding a stuffed toy in her hands.
I feel like the fact that they were holding the toy still shows maybe, hopefully, they didn't, like, suffer in the fire because they're still holding the toy, you know?
Yeah. I suspect that she probably smothered them and then staged them.
Yeah, so at least they didn't suffer.
Yeah, hopefully.
Slow, painful smoke inhalation death. Mm. Hopefully.
So Furaha, the bedding was pulled up over her waist, and the bedroom had not been engulfed by fire, and it appeared that there was mainly fire in the vicinity of the bedhead and her head, as her legs and feet were largely untouched. So police did conduct an investigation to determine who started the fire. They determined there were no signs of forced entry and the house had been locked from the inside. The electricity to the house had been turned off prior to the fire, and the smoke detector battery had been removed. Police also viewed CCTV from the neighbourhood, and Anne could be seen at 4:32 a.m. going to the fuse box of the home. She did something at the box before she went back inside, so I'm assuming that she turned the electricity off. I think also that I've read the smoke detector was hardwired, so it could still work even if the battery was out, but she obviously took the battery out and turned the electricity off.
Yeah, that's probably why she turned it off.
At 4:39 a.m., there is a glow that can be seen in the window of a house indicating that a fire was started. Within a minute, the lounge room was on fire and was consumed by smoke at 4:44 a.m. So that it's still four more hours before the fire brigade was called. So obviously it was a very slow-burning fire for it to take that long for anyone to notice.
Especially, she didn't use, like, any accelerants, right? Like that I've seen.
I don't think. Well, not that I didn't read that in the inquest. I'm not entirely sure.
I feel like
it sounds like
said.
She just set a lot of the bedding on fire, essentially.
Yeah, starting a fire sometimes is harder than you'd think.
Yeah,
as someone with a fireplace growing up that had to try to start fires sometimes, and I was like, this is really hard.
So police also said that they found torn up photos of the family in garbage bags at the residence and that they examined the fuse box and it only had Anne's DNA on it. So basically it seems like they did conduct a very thorough investigation because obviously George would have been a suspect, but in the inquest document it goes into more about how basically he wasn't seen on CCTV, he had an alibi. It was very, very clearly Anne who carried out these murders in this case.
It's very strange that they were literally on the same day.
Yeah, just years apart. That's so weird.
I wonder if Birdie had ever heard of this one.
I saw the February, but I actually didn't realize till we started recording that it was the exact same day.
Yeah.
So for anyone who, we've spoken about this in previous episodes, but for anyone who doesn't know, filicide is the deliberate act of a parent killing their own child. The word can refer both to the crime and the perpetrator of the crime. And just as some, like a quick interesting stat to finish up with, parents were responsible for 61% of children's murders under the age of 5 in a study conducted by the US Department of Justice, which I'm not surprised about. I actually probably thought it would have been higher, but
it's like surprising to hear, but also not surprising when you think about it at all. Just think of how many deaths that we post about that, and who else is really, I don't know, I'm not making sense, but you know what I mean.
I feel like this stat seems low. It says, according to FBI statistics, 450 children are murdered by their parents each year in the US. I feel like I would have assumed it would be higher than that.
Yeah, maybe they mean like on purpose or not counting abuse.
Yeah, maybe.
Like accidental abuse deaths, you know?
Actual premeditated murder.
Yeah, like I'm going to murder this child.
It's interesting to how these cases literally happened on the absolute opposite sides of the world to each other, different hemispheres, but I feel like it's a theme, if that's the right word, that is something that happens to parents all over the world. Like there's always going to be custody battles, there's always going to be disputes, and that, mm-hmm. you know, despite their very different lives, they both use the same methods to carry out the murders.
Yeah. But that is it for these stories. I can't imagine anything else really coming out about Birdie's, like what else could come out, even though it's very recent. But I mean, if something does, I'll put in a clip. That should be it for these stories. So I'd be interested to know everyone's opinions. I'm worried that people are going to have opinions on what we had to say about Birdie, but we shall see. Everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram. That's where we're going to be posting any updates at True Crime Society. If you want to follow our personal accounts, mine is StephSum_Olivia's is TCSOlivia. And we are on Patreon. If you want more content, we do bonus episodes there weekly as well. They used to be just like a half hour, but lately they're getting just like longer and longer. So it's kind of just like another whole episode at this point. And all the episodes there, we release like these episodes as well. They're all ad-free, so you don't have to hear any ads. So you can check us out on there. I think it's very fair, low price. That's really it. Leave us reviews, share the podcast with your friends, comments, 5-star ratings on Spotify.
If you don't enjoy it, we wish you well, but just don't do anything.
Yeah,
just move on.
Please. So thank you guys for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out. Sorry, I'm like brain dead right now. I don't even know how to think.
It's been a,
it's been a long day. Yeah. Okay, bye.
Bye.